Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Alternative medicine is a $70-plus billion global industry. Some people swear by its various branches, homeopathy, acupuncture, chiropractic care, the list goes on. But some skeptics in the medical community say the science doesn't support the claims. It's a hot dispute between those who regard alternative medicine as a trick and those who see it as legitimate treatment. This hour On Point, a tough look at the facts behind alternative medicine. You can join the conversation. Are you a believer in alternative treatments? Have you been healed and helped, or hurt and hoodwinked? What's your view on medicine beyond the mainstream? And joining me now from London is Simon Singh, a best-selling author and science journalist. He's co-author of the new book, Trick or Treatment, The Undeniable Facts About Alternative Medicine. Simon, welcome.
Hi, Auntie.
Good to have you. And joining us from Brussels is the co-author, Edzard Ernst. He's a professor of complementary medicine at the University of Exeter in the UK. He's also author of the Oxford Handbook of Complementary Medicine. And Dr. Ernst, good to have you.
Hi there.
Hello there. Well, let's start with a definition, and let me come to you, Simon Singh, first of all. When we talk about alternative medicine, what do we mean? How do you define it?
It's tricky to define. I suppose the most general definition is any treatment that's considered not mainstream. It's almost better, though, to define it by the individual therapies. So you mentioned earlier things like homeopathy, acupuncture, Reiki, crystal healing, magnet therapy, used all over the world widely, but not considered mainstream.
Mm. This book, I think it's fair to say, in general, comes down pretty hard on these treatments. And you look at three or four of them in particular, acupuncture, homeopathy, chiropractic therapy, and herbal medicine. Edzard Ernst, let me come to you. Did you start out as a skeptic as you headed into this project, or were you a skeptic to begin with?
Well, I started on the other foot. I was a homeopath one time. I studied medicine in Germany 200 years ago, and my first job was in a homeopathic hospital, so I became a homeopath in a way, and I was very much taken by all these alternative things. I'm of that generation, sort of hippie power type of generation, and anti-establishment and all this, which incorporates alternative medicine in a way. And then I became a scientist, and I looked at things differently. My job since 15 years has been to evaluate these therapies in terms of safety and efficacy, and as a scientist you have to look at things in a much more rational way than you do as a clinician. And I somewhat disagree that we're coming hard on down on alternative medicine. I think our approach is entirely scientific, evidence-based, and so forth, and we're just trying to tell the truth.
Well, that's fine. Simon Singh, Edzard Ernst mentioned evidence-based science, and I think one of the points you make right at the beginning of the book, I mean, it is a point that you make right at the beginning of the book and sort of carry through the book, is that when you apply evidence-based science to many of these alternative treatments, they don't hold up. Is that fair?
Yes. Absolutely. The idea of evidence-based medicine is a relatively modern concept, and it's really what's enabled medicine to progress in the last few decades. You take a treatment and you test it. You do a clinical trial. You give the treatment to some patients. You don't give it to the other group of patients. If that trial is conducted well and carefully, then the results are reliable. And that has actually meant that a lot of what we thought were good treatments in mainstream medicine have been discarded or reduced in the amount that they've been used. Now, what we've said is let's have a look at what happens when you apply these same tests to alternative treatments. And surprisingly, I came to this relatively new to the field. I was surprised at how much research had actually been conducted. Literally hundreds of trials examining acupuncture, hundreds of trials, about 200 trials examining homeopathy. And our conclusions aren't based on our personal experiences. They're not based on our prejudices or biases. We simply look at the scientific evidence. And in some cases, as Eddard says, we think there are some positive results there, which we embrace and are happy to encourage people to look at. But in other cases, there is no evidence, negative evidence, and possibly even suggestions of risk.
Well, let's take a case in point. Eddard Ernst, you said you began your career as a homeopath. The book pretty much concludes that the evidence, the overwhelming evidence, is that homeopathy simply doesn't work. Correct?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, why don't we start with, first of all, a description of what homeopathy is? Because I know a lot of people believe in it, but maybe some of our listeners don't know what it is.
I'll explain it very briefly. Homeopaths believe in the like cures like principle, which says that if I cut an onion and my eyes water, then onion-based remedy would be a cure for something like hay fever, which also makes your eyes water. That's the like cures like principle, and it flies in the face of science. The second principle is diluting and shaking the remedy while you dilute makes it not less but more powerful, and that also flies in the face of science. So it is not that surprising that the 200 trials don't add up to very much in terms of homeopathy. And you said homeopathy doesn't work, and I need to just qualify this a little bit. Homeopathic remedies are placebos, but placebos can be very powerful. So seeing a homeopath can be quite an experience in terms of symptoms disappearing and so forth for the patient. But we're not denying the power of placebo or therapeutic encounters or anything like that. We are just telling everybody who wants to know that homeopathic remedies, highly dilute, are placebos.
Mm. Simon Singh, tell the story, if you would, about what you write about quite interestingly in the book of, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, oscillococcinium, which you see for sale in many natural food stores and on natural health counters. This is a cold remedy, correct?
And well, that's right. It's a cold and flu remedy. And I mean, the idea of a very, very small amount of something that can harm you, can possibly cure you, to some people sounds very reasonable, because it sounds a bit like a vaccination. You take a little bit of virus and you give it to somebody and it protects them against that virus. And that's an argument that homeopaths often use. But that's wrong in a couple of ways. And the big way is that homeopathic remedies don't just contain a very small amount of material. They typically contain nothing whatsoever. And the remedy you've mentioned is based on the organs of a duck. So you take, I think it's a Muscovy duck. It's prepared by a French company. They take some of the entrails from the duck. Now, a little bit of that duck is supposed to cure you of flu and colds. So the duck is internal organs are munched up and diluted. A little drop of that is put into more alcohol and water and diluted even more and diluted even more and diluted even more and more and more until the final remedy has nothing left of that duck. And yet the company involved will take little sugar tablets, dip them, douse them in this final little remedy, this solution, and In theory, according to homeopaths, it is the memory of the duck's entrails embedded within that sugar pill that will help patients.
And you point out that, in fact, the packaging states that each gram of medication contains 100% sugar.
To that extent, it's a very, very honest piece of packaging. Hmm. And to some extent, as Eddard said, that little pill will help people because they'll buy into the marketing. They may have read about it in a lifestyle magazine. And instead of that cold lasting for a whole week, it might last just 7 days. Hmm. Now, psychologically, they'll feel they'll be better prepared for that cold, or they'll have got over it better. But in reality, when you do the tests, you know, homeopathy does no better than a sugar pill, because really that's all it is, just a sugar pill.
Mm. So Eddard mentioned the idea of placebo, and that a placebo can be a powerful, is a powerful effect in many cases. So if homeopathy represents a powerful placebo, is it dangerous? Either one. I was going to come. Sure. Let me ask you, Eddard.
Yeah. I've been a clinician a long time and long enough to know that placebos can be useful in clinical medicine. But the point, and it's a crucial point, is that even a treatment that is effective beyond the placebo has a placebo effect, if you see what I mean. So if you just use placebo, you're cheating the patient out of half of the benefit that he should get. And that's dishonest and unethical, and it's simply not on.
But Simon Singh, what about the idea that if it is curing people, and we hear lots of anecdotes that are not curing, treating successfully, I understand we've got to avoid this word cure, but making people feel better, is the idea of placebo in and of itself a bad idea?
Well, I think a remedy that is just placebo, which is what homeopathy seems to be, I find it hard to condone that because it may help people feel better, but it only does that because the patient is being misled into believing they're receiving something that's genuine. And for years now, we've tried to have open and honest relationships between doctors and patients. So I can't condone that level of deceit, even if it's sometimes well-meaning on behalf of the homeopath. Also, if homeopaths can sell us placebo treatments, then can the big drug companies sell us placebo treatments? No, surely not. We wouldn't encourage that whatsoever. So you need to sort of have a level playing field. And also, once people start dabbling in this material, they then start going on to more dangerous forms of alternative therapy. It just opens up a whole Pandora's box.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the hard truths behind alternative medical treatments, and we're talking this hour with Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst, co-authors of the new book, Trick or Treatment, The Undeniable Facts About Alternative Medicine. And Simon Singh, we've sort of dispensed with homeopathy. You also take a look at acupuncture, chiropractic therapy, and herbal medicine, among others. And let's talk about one of those. Chiropractic therapy is used by millions of people, and I must say I certainly have anecdotal evidence from friends and people that I'm very close to who swear by their chiropractor. You write that claims are made that aren't supported by many chiropractic therapists, and that it can lead to serious problems such as dislocation and fractures.
Yes, I think, this idea of adverse reactions is very important. Just very briefly coming back to the idea of homeopathy, we were talking about placebos and can they do any harm. If somebody has a serious condition and they're being treated with a placebo, that's delaying the need for more serious treatment. And one of the ways I got interested in this was people that were using homeopathy to protect them against malaria, which again is just opening up dangers that they really ought not to be confronted with. In the case of chiropractic, it's a more complicated picture because most people will think of chiropractors as manipulating the spine, realigning the vertebrae, and curing various back problems. Now, back problems are notoriously difficult to treat, and I think it's fair to say that chiropractors kind of do as well as anybody else or as badly as anybody else.
When it comes specifically to back problems, right, okay.
That's right, yeah. But the two problems are, one is that there are some quite worrying risks associated with chiropractic spinal manipulation. Some of them are very serious. It can lead to stroke. Those are very, very rare, but serious. And then there are more common problems which are less serious, things like bruising and numbness and so on. So that's one area, that there are adverse reactions and people need to be aware of that. The other problem is that sometimes chiropractors claim to go beyond treating musculoskeletal problems. Asthma, colic, a whole range of things which have nothing to do with our spine. And this dates back to the origin of chiropractic. Daniel David Palmer, the inventor in America about a century or so ago, claimed that chiropractic spinal manipulation could treat or cure 95% of disease because the spine carries the spinal cord, which taps into the rest of our nervous system. And therefore, by treating the back, we can treat any other part of the body. Now, this is clearly absurd, and there's no convincing evidence to suggest that this is possible, and yet there are still chiropractors who will make some of these really quite strange claims.
Mm. But in your research, or in the sort of in the study of the available research on this, and I'm asking you, Edzard Ernst, you found that a chiropractic therapy was good for back pain, correct? I mean, that in many yeah. cases it can treat back pain successfully.
That's right. Simon hinted at the fact that we are all very bad as clinicians to treating back pain. Physiotherapists are somewhat successful, doctors are somewhat successful, and chiropractors are somewhat successful. Nobody is better at it than anybody else. So depending on whether you think the glasses are full or half empty, you say chiropractic is as good as, or you can say chiropractic is as bad as conventional approaches to back pain.
Mm. I want to talk about one.
Anthony, can
yeah,
I just
sure, go
one
ahead,
thing.
Simon.
One of the interesting things about back problems is that about 90% of them clear up of their own accord over the course of about 6 weeks. So individual patients will ascribe success to whatever treatment they're receiving whenever their back problem sort of spontaneously seems to get better. And that's why anecdotal evidence is often unreliable. Now, as it turns out, chiropractors are as good or as bad as anybody else. But it's an illustration of why what our neighbour tells us or what somebody else, a friend of a friend, might have told us is not necessarily the most reliable evidence that we should use in order to consider the treatment for our own conditions or those of our family.
Mm. Simon Edzard, stand by. I want to bring another perspective into this conversation. Dr. James Gordon is joining me now from Washington. He's founder and director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine. He's a Harvard trained psychiatrist and former chairman of the White House Commission on Complementary and Alternative Medicine. His new book is Unstuck, Your Guide to the Seven-Stage Journey Out of Depression. And James Gordon, welcome. Great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to hear your voice. Well, ride to the rescue here and give us another perspective in the face of these sort of skeptics of alternative medicine. You would argue that it has a role. What's the perspective that you would bring to this conversation?
Well, yeah, I'd like to take a couple of steps back from Trick or Treatment, which I think is an interesting and challenging book. But I think the main contribution of this movement toward what we are still calling sometimes alternative medicine over the last 35 years is a profound shift away from modalities that reside solely in the hands of the professional toward techniques of self-awareness and self-care. And I see this as the most profound revolution in healthcare that's happening, and it's really not one that's talked about in Trick or Treatment.
So are you saying that alternative medicine essentially allow the individual to take a little more responsibility for what's going on in his or her body?
Yes, to me that's crucial. In writing Unstuck, which is a practical guide to moving through and beyond depression, what I realized once again is that the most important modalities for people to use for this condition that's regarded as a major depression, or for people who are anxious or confused or troubled, that the most important modalities have to do with contact with another human being who can help them, and with using relaxation, meditation, exercise, changes in diet, and supplementation, and that the other parts of a comprehensive and integrative treatment, which is really what's most important, are more peripheral. So what I'm saying is that central to the healing of depression are those approaches that people can learn from experts or on their own and can use for themselves with the guidance of a professional. Mm. I think that's the most important contribution of this whole movement that we sometimes call alternative medicine, and it's really kind of metamorphosing wonderfully into what we now call an integrative or holistic approach.
But let me just throw this one idea that seems to come out of Simon and Edzard's book, and that is that in general, they say, you know, whether it's acupuncture, homeopathy, chiropractic therapy, and a bunch of others, they don't stand up to this hard idea of evidence-based science.
I think evidence-based science is crucial, and I think both Dr. Ernst's participation in the Cochrane collaboration, which he often cites, is very important. They've done very, very important work in these areas, and the finding of evidence is crucial. But I think we're falling into a fallacy if we regard the major contributions simply as these alternative, so-called alternative techniques. They do have to be investigated, but I would say the larger task, and this is what I do in Unstuck, and this is what I think all of us have to do with all conditions, is to look at a comprehensive and integrative approach. The second piece that I think they neglect in their book, or they refer to indirectly, is how important it is for people to become engaged in their own care. That's much more than placebo. That's a kind of active engagement in taking charge of one's life that is in itself therapeutic.
Well, I want to get both Edzard and Simon to respond to that idea, but I also, there's lots of callers lined up. Let's go to Bill, who's calling from Claremont, New Hampshire. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
Very, very well, thanks.
It's a wonderful show, and I just wanted to call in and say that I'm a good skeptic, and I think homeopathy is a tragic joke and all of that, but herbal medicines, as far as I'm concerned, saved my life.
Well, tell me about that.
I had persistent double pneumonias that resulted in pleurisy, which is a nasty old-fashioned disease and a life-threatening one, and all the antibiotics in the world couldn't knock that out. And in desperation, finally, I went researching and found something called pleurisy root, which is actually the root of the butterfly weed, which a lot of people have in their gardens. And it makes a tea, which tastes, if you'll pardon me, like horse urine, but really has tremendous effect. And as a specific, it cured up my pleurisy.
So it literally saved your life.
As far as I'm concerned, there was nothing else that was knocking down the pleurisy at all. It was just getting stronger over the course of many months. And it would come back, the antibiotics would slow it down, but never stop it, and it seemed to come back stronger, and then this stopped it.
Well, Bill, thanks for that call. Simon Singh, you take on herbal medicine in the book, Trick or Treatment, and in fact, you find that there might be some value to some kinds of herbal medicine, right?
Yes, I think that's where we find some of the most successful treatments in alternative medicine seem to be in this area of herbal medicine. In a way, it's not so surprising because so much of the modern pharmacy is based on medicinal ideas from folklore. And these are real chemicals. Now, that means that they perhaps can really help us. On the other hand, there will be side effects. And so whenever people try an alternative herbal approach, they must talk it through with their doctor, make sure that they won't be open to adverse effects. And just to come back to one of the points that Dr. Gordon was making, I mean, we're absolutely saying that these other factors of lifestyle, of exercise and diet, relationships with other people, these are really important to all forms of healthcare, and they're very, very mainstream. The idea that a good doctor wouldn't give you advice on all of these things is rather strange. So I find it a little disappointing that that's being appropriated as being alternative when it's really very mainstream, and we would certainly endorse that.
Yep. Well, yeah, go ahead, Jim.
What I would add is that I wish they were more mainstream. They seem mainstream, but in fact they're not used as actively as they might. I think what's crucial, and one of the reasons your book is valuable, is because I think you have to take a step back and you have to look at all approaches, and you have to invoke that old Hippocratic dictum, as you did, of first do no harm. And in those instances, there are many approaches that you might use not only before conventional, but also before using some of the alternative therapies you describe. So I think that's an important point.
But we're merely talking about good medical practice. This isn't an issue. But the way I got involved in this in the first place was, I mentioned it very briefly earlier, students were using homeopathy to protect them against malaria in tropical areas. And in fact, I sent a young student to 10 homeopaths, and 10 out of 10 of them were willing to send her unprotected, well, with just sugar pills, homeopathic pills, to a place where she could be dead within 3 days if she got malaria. Now, we also sent her to a conventional medical clinic where they spent most of their time talking to her about covering up her skin, not going out in the evenings, how to be aware of what she was doing, to all those things that you're saying that are really important. And yet the homeopaths routinely failed to deliver those really important basics that we need in order to take responsibility for our own health.
Let's go to another caller. Seth is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Seth.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to say that if there's scammy homeopathic medicine out there, then absolutely it should be investigated and tested and held to the, you know, held to scientific standards. However, particularly with herbal medicines, there's plenty of cases. I'm thinking of one study that compared the effects of St. John's wort and a pharmaceutical antidepressant, where neither one had much of an effect above the placebo. And a big pharmaceutical company used that as an example to discredit St. John's wort, but not their own antidepressant.
Hmm. Yeah, James, Gordon, let me get you to respond to Seth. And Seth, thanks for that call. This issue of research on conventional drugs being mostly financed by the drug company with the kind of resources that are unavailable to alternative medicine. So I guess I'm asking, is there a level playing field here?
Well, I think there are two things. One is it's important to hold conventional medicines to the same kind of standards that doctors Ernst and Singh are holding alternative medicine.
And is that not happening?
And that is the same kind of evidence-based practices. So, for example, when you look, one of the things they talk about is a kind of bias in publishing of studies on alternative medicine. What we found out very recently is that the same bias exists in publishing on conventional therapeutic intervention. So I think we have to look at it at very carefully and see that the same difficulties need to be amended in the conventional world as well.
Hmm. I think Dr. Gordon, I'm just...
Yeah,
I mean,
go ahead,
we talk about level playing fields. The playing field is absolutely tipped in the other direction. And we're not saying that conventional medicine is perfect. There are clearly problems, and we need to keep our guard up and make sure that conventional medicines are effective and they are safe. We remember that all the time. But, I mean, Dr. Gordon, if a pharmaceutical company presented you with the evidence, say, that homeopathy has, would you allow them to market that? Or many of these alternative remedies, do you think they have the sort of evidence that would allow them to get to market if they were conventional drugs? And these are multi-billion dollar industries, so the money is there for the tests. Is the evidence there to support their use?
Hmm. Is that a question for James
Gordon? For Dr. Gordon, yes.
I think, too, though, that the point that Anthony made is correct. There is not the major financial incentive. You cannot patent, for the most part, alternative therapies in the same way that you can drugs. But, you know...
Hang on. So we know there have been 200 scientific trials for homeopathy, so the evidence is there. Is it big enough to support the use of homeopathy, in your opinion?
Well, one of the reasons that we have our National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine here in the U.S. is to study... And I would emphasize the importance of studying those things that are unpatentable, like some of the therapies that you're discussing.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about alternative medicine and the hot debate around the edges of mainstream treatment. And we're talking this hour with Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst, co-authors of Trick or Treatment, The Undeniable Facts About Alternative Medicine. Also joining us is Dr. James Gordon, founder of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine and author of Unstuck, Your Guide to the Seven-Stage Journey Out of Depression. And let's go to a couple of callers who have been standing by patiently. Betsy is calling from Burlington, Vermont. And Betsy, you've got a story about acupuncture, correct?
I do. I've been using acupuncture successfully for about 3 or 4 years to treat bipolar disorder. And I found it to be tremendously successful, particularly if I feel like I'm going a little bit manic. I walk into my acupuncturist, I say, take me down, and I walk out half an hour later, and I am back to sort of baseline.
Wow.
And a lot of people may dismiss that, oh, well, you know, I just had a nice relaxing time. It was very caring. It was very nurturing. But in the course of my research about bipolar disorder, I learned something interesting, which is that in Roman times, people with mania were sent to particular hot springs.
In Roman times, you said? Yeah.
In Roman times.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
They were sent to hot springs. And people might say, oh, well, you know, they just had a nice relaxing time. They took a bath. It was hot. It was nice. Well, it turns out that those particular hot springs that they sent those people to had very high concentrations of lithium.
Hmm.
And so...
And lithium, of course, is used to treat bipolar disorder.
The treatment of choice,
yeah,
mania.
Right.
And so I submit to the skeptics that they simply may not understand the evidence that's being presented to them, which they now think is sort of anecdotal. But there may be something much deeper to it that they just don't know yet.
Hmm. Well, I want to put that to Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst, but I'd also like to hear James Gordon on that. Respond to Betsy, this idea that there might be stuff that is difficult to explain but valid nonetheless less in these treatments.
Can I reply to that?
Yeah, I'll come to you in a second, Dr. Ernst. I just wanted James Gordon first.
Okay.
Well, let me talk a little bit more generally. I use acupuncture as an integral part of my clinical practice. I've gone over the research literature on acupuncture and depression. There is some evidence, I would say, that it works. It's not very strong at all, but there is some evidence. On the other hand, I think we're really at the beginning stages of understanding exactly how acupuncture works and why it works and where it works. My clinical experience in working both with depressed people and with people who are bipolar is that it is extremely helpful in terms of relaxation, in terms of enhancing energy, sometimes helping people get out of the kind of pattern of repetitive and overwhelming thoughts that they have. That said, I do not see it as a single treatment. I see it as a part of a comprehensive treatment, and I think it's also a treatment that needs to be studied further. There have been done some interesting studies, Don John Allen at the University of Arizona, several researchers in China, showing significant improvements in mood in using both acupuncture with electrical stimulation and also without. But I'd say it's in its early stages, it's not definitive, and I have found it over using acupuncture for 30 years to be extremely helpful clinically.
And Edzard Ernst, you and Simon Singh write about the studies on acupuncture in your book, and I guess you conclude that it's a mixed message, correct?
Yeah, very, very mixed, and it's hardly surprising. So many of these alternative treatments are marketed as cure-alls, and certainly acupuncture is marketed as a cure-all, and it simply isn't. It works for some conditions, and it doesn't work for other conditions. We were talking about depression and bipolar disorder and mania, and actually Dr. Gordon probably knows that the systematic review that was published reviewing the literature is by my team, and it concluded that the evidence is simply not there. So we have to ask ourselves, what do we do in this situation? Do we say it might work, or do we? I think it's much more honest to say the evidence isn't there, and okay, we need perhaps further research. But do we actually promote a treatment which is unproven? That is, I think, a crucial question.
Hmm.
You know, Dr.
Yeah, go ahead, James.
The questions that I would ask you and that I've seen in my practice, and I think this is very important, is that we're all so unique and so different biochemically, psychologically, physiologically, so that a treatment may be effective for a group of people and not particularly effective or even ineffective for another group, and we haven't reached that level of sophistication scientifically of understanding for whom a particular treatment, and I would say a particular combination of treatments, might be most effective. We just don't know at this point.
Hmm.
Dr. Gordon, I think the emphasis...
You can't just leave this hanging in the air. This means that you're postulating there are responders and non-responders. And that's a very nice postulate, but you need to somehow demonstrate it. And as long as you cannot prospectively demonstrate that a certain group of people responds to a certain treatment, it is utterly, utterly, utterly meaningless.
Hmm. Well, Betsy, thanks for that call. You ignited an interesting point in this conversation. Let's take another call. Carlin is calling from Upton, Massachusetts. Hi, Carlin.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
I am one person that is a survivor from metastatic lung cancer. I never did chemo. I never did radiation. I had surgery. It then metastasized after 14 months into my lymph system, and I only did alternative treatments.
Can I ask what you did, Carlin?
Yes. I did herbal treatments, a nutritional program. I was on a vegan diet. I did a lot of juicing. I also did chiropractor. I have scoliosis, so that may have come into play when cutting off nerve supply to my lungs.
What's the state of your cancer now, Carlin?
I'm stable. The conventional medical profession told me that they had no cure for me. I could do chemo as a treatment to keep away pain, but it would not cure me. And this was five years ago and 3 months now.
Hmm. And what did the conventional doctors, what kind of time, if I can ask this question, did they give you? I mean, did they predict that you'd be alive in 5 years?
They would not give me time, but they told me that they couldn't cure me. So I said, well, I'll take care of this myself. And I've been working in nutrition and knowing about nutrition since I've been 8 years old. My mother was one of those wackos in the 70s who turned us all into eating properly and eating whole foods, basically.
Right. Well, Carlin, thanks so much for the call, and good luck to you. Simon Singh, what do you hear in Carlin's story? I don't think you take this on in your book, Cancer Cures, Using Alternative Therapies to Cure Cancer, do you?
We discuss it in a few sections of the book, but I think it's wonderful that Carlin's recovered and is doing so well. That's wonderful to hear. But what's very worrying is her advocacy of herbal or chiropractic instead of any conventional treatment. And what's worrying is that there will be thousands of people listening to this who may think, well, actually, this is a line I want to follow. And what we say in the book very strongly is anecdote, one-off episodes. There may be many reasons of what happened that Carlin may or may not be aware of. And therefore, it's unreliable to base what we want to do, our plans for our recovery, on a one-off story. Mm-hmm. So I'd advise people not to be swayed by what's a lovely story.
Well, I think what I hear in Carlin's story, and I want to come to you, James Gordon, is sort of gets back to a point that you made early on. I hear someone who is sick, maybe was sick, who sort of took matters into her own hands, and maybe that has a lot to do with why she's feeling better today.
I think that's true, and I think this is perhaps particularly true with people with cancer, is that they often come up against the limitations of conventional treatment, and the question they generally ask is, what else can I do? And that has two parts. What else? What other therapies are out there? And what can I do to participate? And I think it's crucial always to engage them in participating. As far as the what else, my job as a physician, or sometimes what I call a cancer guide, is to help people with cancer discriminate and make the wisest choices based on the evidence as well as their own desires, because it's ultimately up to them, about what makes most sense for them, and help them put together a program, usually of integrative care, that, for example, would use nutrition and mind-body approaches and might or might not use herbal approaches, might or might not use acupuncture as part of their, and group support as part of their healing process. Mm. I think that's the challenge for all of us. It's not a question of conventional or alternative. It's a question of where's the most evidence and what makes the most sense for each person.
Mm. Simon Singh, I wanted to ask you, I mean, James Gordon raises a point about the limits of conventional medicine. And I want to ask you, why do you think so many people are going to alternative medicine? I mean, doesn't that speak to a limitation of conventional medicine that is driving people, toward another set of answers? And I think one of the answers people are looking for is, why me? Why is this happening? That's a question that conventional medicine often doesn't answer.
Yes, and it's a tricky one, and doctors are dealing with it every day with their patients. I think one of the problems, there are several reasons why people then turn to alternative. One of them is that conventional doctors will often admit the limitations of what they can do, or the uncertainties. I can offer you this therapy, but it may only increase your risk of your chances of survival by 40%. I can try this, I can't guarantee it, or whatever. So doctors are always very clear with their limitations, whereas you'll try a lot of alternative therapists who will sort of say, yes, this is certainly worth a go, you know, this will certainly help you and so on. So there are sort of promised riches out there in alternative world, which are often not necessarily backed up by evidence. And also there's a lot of hype. If you go to the internet or you read lifestyle magazines or you hear what the celebrities have to say, there's over and over again, there are endorsements of alternative therapies which aren't backed up by the evidence. Where they are backed up by the evidence, Professor Ernst and myself wholeheartedly will reinforce that. But in many cases, that evidence just isn't there. And people are being misled by the hype, the celebrity endorsement, the clever marketing, pages on the internet and so on. And this is what we wanted to do. We wanted to get the correct information into people's hand so that they're empowered to make the decisions for themselves.
Mm. Do you think, though, that conventional drugs are being held to the same high standard? I mean, you make a point in the book that the practice of bloodletting years ago was embraced by traditional doctors for years and years and years. In fact, I'd like you to sort of tell that story because it's shocking, really.
Yes, I mean, doctors in Europe and in America used bloodletting on the belief that illness was due to stagnating blood, toxins in the blood, and that by cutting the patient or using leeches and releasing the blood, that would release the toxin in the sickness. And that was thought to help people. Now, in fact, we know that that was only we're literally draining the lifeblood out of patients and doing them far more harm than good. Mm. And it was only scientific testing that identified that bloodletting was dangerous, not helpful. And scientific testing has then allowed medicine to progress, to separate the good from the bad, the effective from the ineffective, the safe from the dangerous, and has brought us to where we are now. And conventional treatments, you know, there are problems with them. They're never perfect. We could do even more testing. But we know that there is a certain level of testing that gives us a certain level of confidence. In the alternative world, unfortunately, it's much more of a wild west where we don't have that confidence in the testing, or where there has been testing and the evidence is pretty negative. Alternative therapists just won't admit that. In homeopathy, we've said that homeopathy doesn't work, that there's no convincing evidence. And homeopaths will have rallied against us and criticized us. And we've said, look, we'll give you $20,000 straight away if you can show us the convincing evidence. Because as far as we can tell, it's not there.
I want to try to get one more call into this program. Let's go to Janet, who's calling from Lexington, Virginia. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I guess my comment would be, to begin with, is that we have to get conventional and alternative information across the board to each other. This is about 10 years ago, I had an obvious pinched nerve, but because of insurance costs, my family practitioner insisted that I try a chiropractor first, then acupuncture, then massage, and at that point I was ready to take a gun to my head. I was just in agony. And it was only after months of this alternative treatment that I finally got the surgery I needed. They removed the disc. I woke up from surgery and said, yes, it's gone. Everything is fine.
Hmm. Now, Janet, I think we're going to just sort of take that call and sort of as a final thought. What do you hear in Janet's story, Dr. Edzard Ernst?
Well, I'm pleased that Janet is better, but I'm worried about all these anecdotes. Anecdotes were the basis of medicine 150 years ago, and we have moved on. If a treatment is of definite efficacy and effectiveness, then we need clinical trials. We don't need anecdotes, and I'm really appalled that on a big station in America, a leading psychiatrist condones alternative treatments as a true alternative, dropping mainstream treatments as a treatment for cancer.
Well,
this makes me sick.
James Gordon, I'm going to give you the final word because that was quite a broadside there. So wrap it up for us. We have about 20 seconds left. James.
Anthony?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to make two points that relate to this.
We have 10 seconds, James, so you really have to wrap it up in a hurry.
Okay. First of all, we may look back in 10 years and see that some of our conventional treatments, for example, the huge overuse of antidepressants, 30 million people in America are just for depression, are just as strange and really should be used just as infrequently or almost as infrequently as leeches are now used in medicine. Second of all, when people have real experiences, whether they're patients or they're clinicians, of using some of these therapies to get well, it is entirely possible, even if the randomized controlled trials and the meta-analyses that are quoted don't show general benefit, it may indeed be that they're having a specific benefit, and we don't know exactly why it is.
James Gordon.
Situation.
Yep. James Gordon, thanks so much for joining us. That's James Gordon, founder and director of the Center of Mind-Body Medicine in Washington, D.C. And thanks to Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst, co-authors of Trick or Treatment, The Undeniable Facts About Alternative Medicine. Thank you, gentlemen. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook.